This episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast is brought to you with NFU Mutual, offering you tailored farming insurance and a local personal service.
The future is about collaboration. We're not the best collaborators, but the future is most definitely about collaboration. It's unsustainable for us to think that we can keep going as we always have done. We've got to be able to collaborate, to buy together, to sell together much better than we have done. So that collaboration message is probably the key one, coexistence.
Working together is vital for the future of farming. So says Minette Batters, who's spent 6 months examining ways to improve farm profitability. Her final report contains 57 recommendations and has just been submitted to DEFRA. We take a look at the main themes. MPs say food production could fall by 32% by 2050 unless the government takes urgent action, and a major food manufacturer says better supply chain relationships with growers and livestock producers are key for business success. Welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. I'm Johan Tasker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
We go straight to our top story. DEFRA is considering 57 recommendations to improve farm profitability. It follows a review by former NFU president Minette Batters, who spent 6 months writing a 50,000-word report. The recommendations will be made public once DEFRA has reviewed them, but Baroness Batters has been talking about the review process. Asked about her take-home message for farmers at this week's REAP conference in Peterborough, this is what she said.
The future is about collaboration. We're not the best collaborators, but the future is most definitely about collaboration. You know, when I look at the cost structure, we've got new machinery up 31% from where it was in 2020. You know, it's unsustainable for us to think that we can keep going as we always have done. We've got to be able to collaborate, to buy together, to sell together much better than we have done, but also knowledge exchange. You know, nobody learns better than in the field. On a farm walk, you know, we don't all need to come into, you know, village halls, and we can learn on the ground. And so that collaboration message is probably the key one, coexistence.
Now, the REAP conference is all about agri-technology, something Baroness Batters said had a key role in profitable farming.
Well, on the evidence that I have here, agritech is front and centre of profitability. You know, we have got to get research and innovation onto every farm, into every field. So it's really, really important of helping farmers be more profitable. The two bits of evidence that I really see are farmers needing to have really good control of input costs and scale. So being able to get that research hitting the ground is really fundamental to driving profit.
That's Baroness Batters answering questions from Farmers Weekly at this week's REAP conference. Louise, Hugh, collaboration, working together, partnership working, not just farmer to farmer, but the industry working better with government and the government working better with the industry. A key theme in this profitability review.
Yeah, I don't know how you force people to do it, because there's loads of opportunity for people to collaborate. I happen to buy a lot of my farm inputs through a phenomenal co-op, which does brilliantly on pricing, and anyone can join in and do that. There are grain selling co-ops out there. There is lots of things going on around collaboration. I think there's certainly some people that do really need to get moving and get into a bit of a unit in terms of selling stuff on that side. And I'm thinking of dairy farmers that aren't tied up with co-ops. They could be in a producer organization. And with what's happening with the dairy market at the moment, it might help. I'm not saying it's going to solve them. We've always said that, but it gives you a bit more of a fighting chance. So she's right about the collaboration, yes. And collaboration around things like machinery infrastructure, yes. It's easy to talk about, but at times it's damn hard to do, particularly when the weather's doing weird things and you're trying to get stuff in the ground or get stuff out the ground and harvested. There are times when you do need control of the kit, even on a small scale, to get it right. But we need to think about that. But certainly collaboration in terms of knowledge, absolutely. But then equally, the pessimist in the room says, or the negative one in the room says, yeah, that's fine. But then at what stage is collaboration good? And then at what point is it IP that makes your different your business different from someone else? Do you want to go and tell all your competitors what you're doing? But yes, there's an element of that, definitely.
Louise Hughes talked a lot there about cooperatives. It's not just about cooperatives. It's also about a better relationship between the industry and government. We'll talk about the way DEFRA and the government, how they value farming and agriculture and food production in just a moment. But Minette and Hugh also mentioned machinery, which is a big thing in the arable sector at the moment. This idea of working together simply because machinery is so, so expensive.
Yes, it is a big thing, and it's a growing thing as well. So various ways of doing that. But I think, as Minette pointed out, actually, costs have gone up by 31% of machinery, and we know what the outlook is at the moment for arable farming. So it's just not viable, possible for everybody to have their own great big machines and the technology that they contain. So, yeah, you've got to share them, find other ways of getting them on your farm at the time that you need them most.
And the other thing to consider about machinery as well, and this is a really tricky one to bust, but do we not need to think, and this is the whole supply chain in machinery, so manufacturers through to dealers through to farmers, do we need to blow apart the current principle of owning and start thinking about more rental as other sectors do with large bits of kit? Now, the manufacturers might not like it because they just want to keep selling us stuff, but actually, if you look at other sectors, be it construction, mining, they just hire kit in and then it goes again. And this idea of owning, so you hire it. We do that to a certain degree within farming now, but do we need to do more of it?
Louise, these comments by Minette Batters at the REAP conference and the Agritech conference, Agritech too going to play a huge part in farm profitability?
Yes, I think it is going to. I, as you know, do a lot of work in the arable sector. That's highly technical sector, and there's some really smart bits of kit out there now. Equally, there's also some very expensive stuff out there. And I think there's always a tendency that everyone thinks that this new technology is going to help the much larger farms. But actually, we need technology that helps all sizes of farms. And we also need technology which can be used by agronomists, consultants, whoever else is coming onto that farm and working with the farmer. So I think it's wrong to pigeonhole it in just for a really big go-ahead farm. We've got to think about its wider role and how it can help all farms. The other thing, and I know actually that Tesco is doing this, they are testing out some of the new technology and new innovations on their low-carbon concept farms. They're testing out on behalf of farmers. So they're saying, does this really work? What does it cost? Can it be used in a practical farm setting? And does it deliver the benefit that we've been led to believe it's going to deliver? And I think that's really, really helpful. And I think we need more of that. I guess we're coming back to collaboration now, aren't we? But yeah, let's get this technology out there, but let's make sure it's the right technology and it's not costing so much money that it's very difficult to get a return from it.
And it's not all about robots and drones either, is it, Hugh? And collaboration, coming back to collaboration and agri-tech, I mean, a good example, data sharing.
Yeah, data sharing, look, it's a big thing that we need to get better at, because if we could share data more easily, more cost-effectively and more effortlessly, that's the thing, it could make our life so much easier on farm and feed at every level of the supply chain. I constantly bang on about this, but it does frustrate me. And it's something that we could so easily fix really quickly.
Now, Minette Batters, not only speaking at the REAP conference this week, but also addressing the Northern Farming Conference in Hexham, where she admitted she thought long and hard before accepting DEFRA's invitation to lead the Farming Profitability Review. The responsibility felt enormous, she said, and the decision whether or not to lead the review, well, nearly all of the advice was don't do it. It's a hospital pass, she was told. People will hate you. You'll ruin your reputation. In the end, said Minette Batters, I asked my two neighbours, Ed Parsons and Will Dixon, and they both looked at me and they said, oh, for goodness sake, get on and do it. If not you, then who? Hugh, do you think Minette was right to accept the invitation, a farm review led by a farmer? Or do you think it would have been better to have been led by someone outside the industry, an outside expert looking in, as it were, an economist?
I think she's as good as anyone to do it. She's looking at it from a farmer's perspective. She's represented farmers for many years of her life at the highest level. So she got some idea of what's hot and what's not and what'll work and what won't work. You could have put a world leading, economist in there to go and look at it, and they'd probably come back with similar conclusions, but in slightly different language. So I think that at the end of the day, it's going to be about what the recommendations are and what those look like. And until we see those, then it's very hard to judge.
And Louise, what are your thoughts? I mean, people saying it's a poison chalice, I understand that. But Minette Batter's also saying at the Northern Farming Conference that she had a small team working with her at DEFRA. She said none of them knew anything about farming at all, which I thought in the beginning was going to be a real problem. But it actually forced me to explain every single thing, including the why. And it forced me also to deliver on the how. So a farm review led by a farmer, good or bad?
Oh, me personally, I think it has to be undertaken by a farmer, actually, because I think that's probably where things have gone a bit wrong in the past, where we've had a review or a report which doesn't really always demonstrated the understanding of the sector and the little foibles and things that go on. I mean, I do think it's interesting that Minette has admitted, hasn't she, that she had to think long and hard about whether she did take up this role and whether she did this review. So I think you used the term poison chalice, didn't you, Johan? But she obviously had some concerns about that. But anyway, it's done now. She's done the review. I think she let slip there are something like 57 recommendations. So we'll have to see what the government makes of those and how many they put into practice.
Yeah, the whole idea of this poison chalice thing is purely driven, isn't it, by the political landscape. You know, had the inheritance tax bomb not dropped last October, it would have been exactly what you'd expect a former NFU president to go off and do. So I think she's right to have carried on and done it regardless. I get that, you know, you might be seen to be working for the enemy and all this old BS, but at the end of the day, let's hope she's got in there, had a good route round, sorted out what's on, and actually produced what might be a useful evidence base for the industry going forward. And that's what we hope will come out of this.
Now, Minette Batter says she was given the independence and freedom she wanted to write the review, but DEFRA made clear she would be influencing the government's land use framework, food strategy and farming roadmap. She was also told to be compliant with the Climate Change Act and mindful of the government's net zero objectives. I know I could have written a great review that you would all have loved, she told the Northern Farming Conference, but it would have sat on a shelf forever and a day. In other words, Louise, rather than writing a report that's just going to please farmers, she's taken a pragmatic approach in the hope that this gives her recommendations the best chance of being implemented in full.
Yeah, she has had to do that. And to be honest with you, what is the point of a review, a report that then just sits on the shelf and gathers dust? You know, we've talked about this at length, haven't we? Farming is going through a period of unprecedented change. And we've been, muddling along, quite honestly, for the last year and a half in an absolute vacuum of information. We don't know what the policy is, what the government wants from farmers. So, yeah, it's got to be something that can be implemented to everybody's benefit and to move the whole thing forward. So, just to produce a report that keeps a few farmers happy is just not going to achieve anything, is it?
Now, another key recommendation, Louise, is for the government to recalculate agriculture's GDP value to capture what Minette Batter says is its full contribution from food production to tourism, recreation and the wider rural economy. She says UK agriculture's official valuation that it contributes just 0.6% to GDP is a gross underestimation that leads Whitehall to dismiss the sector as irrelevant.
Yeah, that's right. And I have to say, I do absolutely agree with her that the sector just isn't taken very seriously in Westminster. And that's probably one of the reasons why. I mean, there were some figures out this week from the bank HSBC, and it didn't look at farming separately. It said the agri-food chain contributes 6.5% of national GDP and actually accounts for nearly 12% of employment. So, yeah, I think we've just got to be seen as something bigger, to be taken more seriously. And yeah, it's a key component of the UK economy, just not some little activity that happens on the side and doesn't produce very much.
It's an interesting concept, isn't it? This idea of recalculating agriculture's contribution to GDP so it reflects its wider significance beyond food production to sectors such as leisure and tourism. It's a similar approach, Hugh, to the approach that they take in Australia and New Zealand. Do you think it more accurately reflects the importance of agriculture, or do you think it artificially inflates it beyond levels that are credible?
I think what you've got to do is you've got to identify the value of having that food onshore, that you're producing it here, and think about that in the cliche, food security is national security or vice versa. I mean, what it does reflect, doesn't it? It tells you how cheap food is. It's the classic, we're a victim of our own success. We've become that efficient that we made food so cheap with the help of the market and being pushed down, 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 and being made to be more and more competitive, or even though we're not actually that productive. So because it's cheap, perhaps it's not in everyone's mind's eye, but it is a key part of the economy. And I think that's the key thing, because if you take that food production away, then some huge holes appear. You know, we're never more than two loaves of bread away from anarchy. And if the shelves start suddenly emptying, then all hell lets loose. So I think we've probably, yes, we have been undervalued in terms of how important we are to the functioning of the economy and the country. And I think it's, you don't want to fudge the figures, but you actually want to say, well, the reason we're undervalued is because we're doing a pretty good job at producing. We could do an even better job. But that's a really precious 0.6%. Take that away, and suddenly you're no longer one of the three cheapest shopping baskets in the world, because you've got to go delivery style and import everything in.
This recommendation then, Hugh, that agriculture's contribution to GDP should be recalculated to reflect its wider significance to the rural economy, very similar in concept to the rural powerhouse idea promoted by the Country Land and Business Association, that the countryside is full of untapped potential and farming's contribution extends way beyond food production.
Yeah, it is. And that rural powerhouse piece that was done a few years ago, we've talked about it lots. And it's a great sort of concept that you can unleash all this economic power in rural areas with the right infrastructure, with the right encouragement. And when they've looked at the numbers, farming, you know, it's less than 5% of the turnover of your average rural economy. You know, it's a huge land area, obviously, because that's all you can see when you stand there looking out over the hedges and the trees and all the wonderful fields and the crops and the animals, yada, yada, yada. But its value in terms of what it's delivering, there's a shed ton of money there in terms of the value of the land and the stuff on it and all the kit that needs to work with it. But the actual value to the economy and the local economy, it's a really small part, but essential. So it's, yeah, let's not fudge the figures. Let's just make sure that it's utterly highlighted as a very precious 0.6%, which is utterly crucial to the functioning of the nation.
Now, one more recommendation before we do move on from this report is for country of origin food labelling to be applied to the out-of-home sector. Only one in the 15 steaks eaten out-of-home, that's in bars, restaurants and hotels, is a British Aberdeen Angus steak, Minette Butters says. So what I've recommended is that the code needs to be applied to the out-of-home sector and it needs to become a statutory requirement. Louise.
Yeah, apparently that is one of the recommendations. So that is going to, you know, really expand labelling, because I think it's about 30% of what we eat is what they call out of home. So as you say, that's the cafes, the restaurants, the takeaways. So that's going to be quite an opportunity if that's a recommendation that is, you know, put into practice.
Hugh, Minette's saying that she wants this code applied to the out-of-home sector. And not only that, it needs to become a statutory requirement.
Yeah, it's a good idea. And it just highlights that whether it's British or not, but let's remember that I know why she's saying it, because we know a lot of the out-of-home, so catering sector meats would be imported products. The other thing is when you talk about, you know, I heard the audio from the Northern Farming Conference, as she talks about in the context of steaks. Well, 62.4% of all the meat that's eaten out of home, of the 30% of expenditure that we eat out of home, okay, 62.4% is chicken. So, yes, we can get English on the steaks, but actually thinking about it, it's a small percentage of the actual volume that's going through. So let's not, yeah, this is a great thing. It's a lovely idea, but it's not, I don't think it's going to be life-changing. And the other thing, of course, if we're going to put British all over it, and make sure that everyone always comes back for a British steak, then we've got to get a bit better at producing a more consistent British steak so they keep coming back. You know, as well as price, one of the reasons that catering outlets might enjoy buying Australian is because it's a damn consistent product that comes over. I'm not saying it's as consistent as chicken, but it's not far off because of their scale. So we've got to think about the implications as well. But I don't think it's a nice thing. I don't think it's a life-changing thing.
A life-changing steak, Hugh? Well, that would be a thing, wouldn't it? Will it be, though, a life-changing farm profitability review? We'll have to wait and see. DEFRA says it will be published in full in and around mid-November. But hopefully we've given you a taster, steaks and all, of what it contains.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And now a special word with this week's podcast partner, NFU Mutual. And I'm joined by NFU Mutual's Evita Van Gestel. Evita, tell us about NFU Mutual's risk management services, NFU Mutual RMS.
NFU Mutual Risk Management Services offer tailored on-site health and safety advice from expert consultants who understand farming. So whether it's checking if farm machinery is safe for use, reviewing loan working procedures, or helping the business to meet things like red tractor safety standards, we're here to help. What's important is that our consultants don't just tick boxes. They work with the farmer to find practical and workable solutions that protect their people, property, and ultimately their livelihood.
So lots of reasons then for farmers to consider using NFU Mutual RMS themselves, yeah?
Yeah, so farming is statistically known to be one of the UK's most dangerous industries. It sees many incidents such as falls from height, accidents resulting from livestock handling, and hazards from farm machinery and vehicles, but also farm fires. So from NFU Mutual statistics, we know that farm fires are estimated to have cost NFU Mutual in excess of £102 million in 2024 alone. But for a farmer, that impact goes far beyond financial loss. So it can mean the loss of livestock, crops, equipment, and even lives. And many of these incidents are preventable. That's where NFU Mutual's risk management services come in. So our team of expert consultants work directly with the farmers to identify hazards, improve safety, protect livelihoods. Whether it's a dairy farm in Devon or an arable operation in East Anglia, we tailor our advice to the specific business, their people, their operation, and ultimately their priorities.
So this is about being proactive then, and it's about good risk management. All of this sort of stuff really matters to farmers.
Yes, it does. Many of the most serious claims that we see, some costing millions, as we've mentioned before, could have been prevented with the right systems in place. And while insurance helps with when things go wrong, prevention is always better than a payout, not least for the moral reasons of protecting your people and also the legal requirements that need to be complied with. So our service is confidential, it's independent of any insurance policy, and is designed to support compliance with legal standards and schemes like Red Tractor as well.
So as a farmer, how do I go about booking an RMS visit?
You can get in touch with us either through your local NFU Mutual agents, if you're insured with us, or you can go to the NFU Mutual website, which is nfumutual.co.uk, and you can search for risk management services. And finally, you can call us on 0800 132 029, and we'll be happy to talk to you about our services.
Evita Van Gestel from NFU Mutual, this week's Farmers Weekly podcast partner. Thank you very much.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, while Minette Batters was talking up farm profitability this week, MPs have been highlighting the importance of farm productivity. Without urgent action, they say, a quarter of farmland could be lost and food production could fall by one third by 2050. That's the message from the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Science and Technology in Agriculture. Hugh caught up with APPG Chairman George Freeman MP to find out more.
2050 sounds a long way away. It's not. We've got 25 years to do this. How? Well, that's what we're setting out today. It is doable. It's perfectly within our means. We have the science and the technology. In the UK, we're a global powerhouse. The world is investing billions. And yet we are telling our farmers we want them to produce less. And they're getting out of business. This is madness.
The challenge really, as well as getting the government policy and the money behind it, the other big challenge is getting it onto farm, isn't it? How do we break that one? Because, I mean, that is probably the biggest challenge of all.
It is the biggest challenge of all. And the big failure has been, you know, after the war to 1980s, we were really good. We increased cereal yields by about 20, 30%. And they've flatlined, gone down a bit since. Why? Well, I think it's basically a combination of things. Firstly, policy. When governments say to the farming industry, we want you to produce less, and we want you to farm grants and subsidies, and we want you to get into solar and give your hand up for housing, guess what? Farmers will follow the signals. But it's also an industry structure failure, because there are commercial growers and farmers who want to get access to the innovation. But our innovation ecosystem is very academic. And I tried to shake it up as minister. Of course you need great blue sky science. But in UKRI and Innovate UK, they're too disconnected from the reality of the farms on the ground, which is why in the 2013 AgriTech strategy, I put £40 million into creating some regional agri-innovation centres. Unfortunately, the money got snaffled by the scientists and went back into the lab. But this is key, but you're only going to get that if government makes it really clear we want to produce more and we want to support farmers who produce more.
And just the political landscape now, there'll be people listening to this thinking, well, where we are, you know, this government doesn't care about agriculture. We've got four more years to an election. Why is George bothering? How can you change, do you think, in terms of, you know, you're very much in a party of opposition and very low numbers. How can you change this landscape politically?
Well, not through party politics. That's why I'm very proud to chair the all-party group for agricultural science and technology. No party has a monopoly of this at all. And in a way, that's healthy, because party politics is pretty boring and pretty discredited at the moment. I think the message for your listeners, but also for people out around here, around the country, who are not that interested in agriculture, did you know that our food supply, our international food resilience is falling, that our self-sufficiency in food is falling? Did you know that Russia is waging an asymmetric cyber war on our supply chains? Did you notice in the pandemic that things we thought we could rely on, including vaccines, were easily accessible? They're not. Do you know we're only a few days away from empty shelves? Do you know that UK policy for 15, 20 years has been encouraged farmers to grow less? Are you concerned yet about this? Are you aware that we're a powerhouse of showing the world and delivering for the world double food production on half the land area? We've got the science, but we're not doing it. How crazy is that? So I think there's a message here for a public that is rightly disillusioned by party politics. You should be frustrated. Join us in a patriotic rally for the muddy, booted and dirty overalled farmers of Britain who want to feed us with British food. I think that's an argument that'll resonate with voters in Labour seats, Tory seats, no seats, all around the country.
George Freeman, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's George Freeman from the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Science and Technology in Agriculture. So, Hugh, without urgent action, a quarter of farmland could be lost and the supermarket shelves will be empty. Really?
Well, I think we are. We know that the system is teetering on the edge. We know how challenging it is to run farms, let alone provide continuity in the supply chain. So, yeah, we are teetering on the edge a bit here, and not just in this country, in every other sort of country in the world, really. There's loads of pressure on, so it's really important that we get our head around this productivity thing. And as you heard in the audio from George Freeman, the government, or successive governments, for 25, nearly 30 years, have just told us, you know, food's not that important, but you can, you know, do diversification and you can do lots of other things that doesn't involve producing food. So surprise, surprise, there isn't much food around. And what food is around, again, it's back to the whole line. And we've said it before on the podcast, the one thing that's really stubborn when you look at inflation figures is the cost of food. And because supply is tight and values are high. And that is why it's really important that we get on this and we get in control because we need that resilience as a country in terms of our food supply, and we need to be on it, and we need to making the best use of every piece of farmland. And the final, the big headline piece at this conference really was talking about some of the land use study work that's been done. And you may have seen some of it in the papers over the last week or two, where it says that if you take out all the land that we need to do all the other stuff, so the sort of greening stuff, the habitat creation, the biodiversity net gain, landscape, whatever, all of that greening stuff, then you take out all the house building, the flood alleviation, all the solar panels going onto land and everything else, you could lose 25% of your productive farmland. So by just that default alone, you need to increase your productivity by the equal amount so that you stand still where you are now.
25% of currently farmed land, that's a huge proportion. And 2050 isn't that far away, Louise.
That's right. I mean, George did really stress that, didn't he? That's you've got 25 years, only 25 years to do this. And he's talking about, you know, doubling food production with half as much of the resources that we're using at the moment, so that the impact of that comes right down. So, yeah, we've got to get on with it, got to get moving. It really, 2050 really isn't that far away now.
25%, though, that's a huge proportion. It's a quarter of our productive capacity. Hugh, is this exaggerating to prove a point? Is it a little bit like saying soil health is so poor that there are only 60 harvests left, or is it realistic?
Well, however you skin the proverbial cat, what we're doing at the moment is not good enough. And it will only take, you know, a few shocks in the wrong place and the wheels could calamitously come off the cart. So we need to get on this whole idea of productivity. And I think the key thing here and the key ask from this group is talking about, and this is a cross-party group. I was at the conference, we had people from DEFRA in the conference. You know, we need to start embedding this idea of, you know, farmland is for food production into our policy and how we create policy. And particularly now where we're standing at this sort of turning point in terms of ag support, it's a huge change in a short period of time. There's not likely to be that much ag support going forward. So we've got to think really carefully about how policy going forward impacts on that food production. Because if you stand off and don't support anything and just do nothing, then that food production can continue to decline, which makes us hugely vulnerable if there's any sort of geopolitical huge shocks like Ukraine's type things happen again, or World War III, or whatever the heck happens next. And it also makes us hugely vulnerable if we're importing more and more product, because ultimately we become the ultimate, you know, global price takers, relying on other countries elsewhere to grow all our food for us. So we have got to get on this, and we can do it. It's totally achievable. It's what, you know, was talked about 15 years ago when the government started to think about this, but then put it in the too difficult box and left it alone because everyone was too busy banging on about greening, and greening is more appealing to voters than food production. But then if the shelves go empty, food production might become more appealing than greening.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Arable farming made easy with Avant. Transform your operations with our powerful, versatile loaders. With over 200 attachments, Avant loaders help boost productivity. Watch your yields grow. Search for Avant now.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You're listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Welcome along wherever you're listening to us from. You can email us, podcast@fwi.co.uk. And if you're in the UK itself, you can also message us by texting the word farm, followed by your message to 88440. Hugh, a busy week for you this week?
Yes, lots going on this week. I had a part two of my soils workshop, which was really good. I went up to a lovely farm just near Milton Keynes and looked down a hole in a field, but it was very informative and I learned lots. What else has been happening this week? NFU health and safety with livestock session. That was on farm this week as well. That was really good. Very busy as ever, and in a bit of farming in between.
A busy week for you, Hugh. A busy week too for industry leaders. The budget on the 26th of November drawing ever nearer. Lots of lobbying going on in the run-up to that budget, and an interesting NFU council meeting at Stoneleigh Park this week, Louise.
Yeah, that's right. And we're all on tenterhooks, aren't we, to see what's going to come out in that. Braced for the worst and hope for the best. So, you know, there's been a lot of work done by the NFU. You can't dispute that. Not everybody agrees with the tactics and all the rest of it. And that's all for another day. But they have done a lot of work on this. And we hope for the best, I think.
Yeah, NFU President Tom Bradshaw certainly putting in the hard yards when it comes to lobbying behind the scenes to try and get this inheritance tax decision reversed or at least tweaked to make it workable for farmers. There may not be an announcement in the budget on the 26th of November, Hugh. Probably more likely to come in the finance bill early in the new year. And Tom Bradshaw at that NFU council meeting appealing for unity, not just within the industry, but within his own NFU council as the NFU continues to make the case for farming.
Yeah, I mean, what's obviously the finance bill contains everything that was suggested in last year's budget. So that's what's in it. Now, it may be that they make an announcement in the budget. Who knows? But yes, look, loads of time and effort has been put into this topic, and it's not surprising as to why, because most of the NFU members are going to be, whether they're landlord, tenant or whatever, or landowners, they're going to be affected by this either way. It's a huge deal, we know that. It's a huge preoccupation. It's caused loads of worry. It's caused lots of things to happen. So lots of resource and time has been put in. I think the other thing to remember as well, and I don't just say this because I'm an NFU person and I've always been involved with the NFU, I'm not just blowing smoke up its derriere, but just also bear in mind that as well as all of that IHT stuff that's been going on, there's a whole load of other lobbying stuff that's going on at the same time. So it's a huge thing, spinning all these plates, trying to keep things moving forward. And there is so much other stuff going on as well, which actually in normal times, if you look at it, would be seen as the huge, you know, topics of the day, whether we're talking around stuff around, say, for example, emissions, farming rules for water, et cetera, et cetera. But this IHT thing is such a big thing. And it has got the potential to have such a huge impact on so many farm businesses across the country that it's worthy of the time and effort that's been put in. And I think it's unfair. Some people have criticised, oh, yes, the NFU is just marginalising themselves, becoming the IHT lobbying centre. It's not, because it's still doing all the other stuff as well. And normally, all the other stuff wouldn't get that much press anyway, because it's very industry-centric. It's very internal within the sector itself. So, still lots to do, still lots of letters to write, still lots of stories to tell to people about why this matters and why it's such a big deal and why we need to keep pushing on as we are.
And inheritance tax, not the only hot topic this week, Hugh. Bird flu in the headlines again for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, it is. And the instances of bird flu, for those of you who get the emails from APHA, have really ramped up in the last couple of months. It's bubbled around all summer. Ian Brown, who's top virologist at APHA at the EPIC conference, that's the Egg Industry Poultry Conference in South Wales this week, saying that what they're dealing with, the strain at the moment, it's mutated. It hasn't mutated much at all. It's been very, very stable, this virus. And then suddenly it's just slightly mutated, which seems to be making it a lot more sticky, and it's causing some real problems. I was talking to someone the other day, which I think highlights the need or how effective good biosecurity can be. And we tend to probably be the pig and poultry industries are always all over biosecurity. The rest of the animal sectors probably not doing as much as they could do. But this illustrates how good it can be and how effective it can be. I was talking to a friend who's one of their neighbours in the area had tragically had a bird flu outbreak, took out a lot of laying birds. There were several sheds and the virus went into several of the sheds, but not all of them, because the biosecurity was so good between the sheds. Unfortunately, the APHA people made them take all of the birds out. But I think it just highlights how important biosecurity is, particularly at this time of year when there's a lot of smaller poultry producers, seasonal poultry producers, who must be really worried with all that's going on. So we absolutely must do our best to maintain that biosecurity, dip your feet when you should, and make sure you've got a good biosecurity if you've got livestock on your farm as well.
Yeah, a timely reminder to keep on top of biosecurity. Time now, though, for this week's market prices in association with the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board. Hugh, what's happening?
Thank you very much. Johan finished their dead weight this week, 655.6. That is up just about 3.5p on the week from last week. The dead weight steer average, 368.3. That drops back around about 7p on the week. Sheep, SQQ dead weight this week, 662.5. It's slightly up about a penny. The live weight goes up around about 7p, 315.3 live weight. Pig price, I'm afraid, has dropped again this week, 201.8, back from 203.7. That's quite a bit back from last year, because last year it stuck around 207 all year pretty much. A year ago it was 207.1, so that's a fair chunk back, particularly for the pig price, because it doesn't tend to move that much. Onto the arable markets, there is not too much movement there, I'm afraid. In fact, it's pretty sanguine. Feed wheat, 1665, £166.50. That has gained a massive 50p on the week. So just count yourself lucky. You've got an extra 50p if you happen to be selling this week. Compare that to a year ago, feed wheat was £178.70. Milling wheat this week, 179.70. That's dropped back about a pound on the week. Barley almost stands on. It's gone up a massive 10p a ton, £145.40. Oilseed rate, 409.20. That's dropped back all of 20p on the week, so not too bad there. Feed beans, feed peas have gone up a tenner, £203 a ton. Feed beans go up £2 to £204.30. The diesel is going up. What's going on? This is telling me 70.70. So that's gone up nearly 2p on the week. So 70.70 pence, or 70.7 pence per litre on this week's Wednesday morning ring round, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Hugh. And for trusted market data delivered straight to your inbox, visit the AHDB Preference Centre at ahdb.org.uk/market-data to sign up for and customise AHDB market emails.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And now a special message from Bayer. Aim high with DeKalb hybrid maize varieties from Bayer, the smart choice for biogas production. Introducing DK2742, the high-output main crop maize from Bayer. Powered by DeKalb's global maize breeding expertise and agronomic innovation, DKC2742 is built for reliability. It offers strong early vigour and reliable establishment, delivering high-quality, high-biomass maize across a range of growing conditions. Talk to your seed supplier about DeKalb maize now. Strong start, big energy. DeKalb DKC2742 by Bayer.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, the phase out of direct government support for farming means growers and livestock producers must look elsewhere to increase or even maintain their incomes. One possible solution is closer supply chain relationships. A report published by potato processing giant McCain Foods this week suggests more than 70% of growers see sustainable farming practices as essential to the future of farming. Louise and I caught up with James Young from McCain, and I started by asking him why the company conducted the study.
We have lots of conversations with the growers that we work with and partner with. There's 250 potato growers across the UK, and we have lots of conversations about potato growing, as you can imagine. And, you know, there's been a definite change of tone over the last couple of years with our growers. So we thought we would just sort of lift our heads a little bit and wanted to understand the conversations and the impacts across broader agriculture, so not just potato growers. So the survey does go out to farmers across all parts of agriculture across the country, just to try and get a better indication of the mood and the confidence and the optimism levels on a broader scale.
One of your findings, a key finding, was that more than 70% of farmers see sustainable farming methods as vital to the future of UK agriculture and indeed to their own farm businesses.
Yeah, so there are reasons to believe, I suppose, that come out of this survey, as well as a lot of the concern within it. And growers are desperately keen to embrace new ideas, new technology, new practices. And, you know, I think that's a good sign. I think there's reasons why some of them aren't doing it at the moment, but the intent and the ambition is and the commitment is very much there. So we want this survey to be a call to arms for the industry and for government to try and tap into that and encourage that even more so that the farmers are able to do that and able to apply all that ambition.
And something else that you found in or is mentioned in this report, James, and that is that 51% of farmers are considering quitting the industry. How worried are you about that?
We are worried, Louise. It is a concern. And what will happen to, you know, not just our business in terms of supply of good quality potatoes, but for wider food production? You know, it's at that level now. And again, that's why we did this survey across the whole industry, because it is a concern to UK food supply. And if you think of all the knowledge and experience of generations of farmers, and if they change their business model or do go out of business and don't farm, then that's a huge loss, not just to McCain for potato supply, but for the country as a whole when it comes to food production.
One of the reasons so many farmers are considering quitting the industry is that farming for many of them simply doesn't pay at the moment. So how do we make sustainable farming pay in the absence of things like government support?
So we have a responsibility as a food business, you know, buying a farm product, then we have a big responsibility. And we have taken lots of actions in the last couple of years, actually, from that contracting and commercial point of view with our potato growers, whether it's significant changes in the price or whether it's other support and helping with cash flow and investment support as well into infrastructure, then, you know, we've done lots of activities that has put a lot of money into McCain potato growing for the last 2 or 3 years. But those growers are only growing potatoes as part of a wider rotation. And if that's not the case across the full rotation, then that's why we have this risk of growers going, of farmers going out of business. So I think there's a role for businesses to address that and the responsibility I talk about there that we share. But I do, yeah, the absence of government support, but I wouldn't, you know, personally don't like to kind of back down and think there won't be that support. The takeouts of the survey and the FarmDex report are really a request to government that it isn't just no support, and there are things that government can do. And we get the point about the budget constraints at government level, but there are still things that can be done. And I again, you know, thinking optimistically, if I think of the framework that's come out of the food strategy work, if I think about the profitability review, I think about the land use framework, you know, as well as reviews of ELMS and SFI, then these are positive things that are going on, but they're all a bit up in the air. So they have to land well and turn into policy and complement each other, not be conflicting with each other. And I think if they do, then, you know, there is reason to be optimistic. I think that will really help. Back to your point and your question about those practices and farmers, you know, and their ambition and being able to deliver that.
And when we've spoken to you before, James, we've heard about McCain's ambition to source 100%, virtually all of your potatoes from farmers practicing regenerative farming methods. There are some that will say you're having a laugh, aren't you? That potato growing requires masses of soil movement and techniques such as de-stoning, constant blight sprays. But how are you getting on with that target, with that ambition?
We're getting on quite well, Louise. There are people that say that, but there are fewer than there were a couple of years ago, to be honest. So we are making progress. I think when we measure it in terms of our, so we have our regenerative agriculture framework at McCain that we have. We talked about it in a field in Lincolnshire, didn't we, last year? And we measure against that all of our growers' practices, and they are making progress. You know, they're moving across that framework. So you mentioned de-stoning. You know, on some land, that's absolutely still necessary. But then there's others where growers are trying to do a bit less. And there's some new technology still that we talked about before, but it's becoming more and more mainstream and more realistic, and that is helping. So there's a bit of a reduction in de-stoning, reduction in other cultivation passes as well. And there's good progress being made, for sure. And I put that down to a number of different things, but not least that kind of knowledge transfer and sharing amongst the growers of the trials and the research work that's going on out there. And it really is starting to make a difference now. So, you know, I'm even more excited about that, to be honest. And I think there's still plenty more we can do. But, you know, potatoes has got to be, as have, you know, other vegetables, root crops have got to be part of that discussion about the future of sustainable farming and regenerative agriculture, so that we're talking about the whole food system, not just certain crops.
So you're collaborating very well with growers. Your report, at the end of the report, there are a call to action and there are five main points there. What can McCain do to get these messages or help get these messages through to government and get that support that the industry so badly needs?
That's one of the objectives of publishing this report. So we hope that government will see that, and we're happy to talk through some of those asks in more detail and through our partnerships with growers. We bring farmers to the table for that discussion as well. So we do, you know, we do think there's conversations to be had, and our experiences and our learnings on regenerative agriculture, the conversations we're having with those small family farms that supply us as well. You know, there's a lot to be taken from that. And I think if we could sit down with government and help, as I mentioned earlier, about those different things that are in the air at the moment, help those land in the right way for food businesses like ours, but crucially for farmers as well, for that long-term stability of food production in the UK. And I think, you know, it's a great opportunity and we'd love to do that.
That's James Young from McCain Foods talking to us here on the Farmers Weekly podcast. And that's about it for this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast. We do hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've really enjoyed what you've heard, please do leave us a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with all the latest news, views and analysis of all the big stories affecting UK agriculture. But for now, until next week, I'm Johan Tusker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
Thank you for listening. This episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast was brought to you with NFU Mutual, offering you tailored farming insurance and a local personal service.